If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Before we get started, we want to tell you a bit about the sponsor of this week's History Extra podcast, Warner Hotels. If you're looking to escape to a picturesque corner of the UK for a few days, Warner Hotels has just the thing for you. Each hotel offers everything you could possibly need for the perfect weekend away. From unrivaled leisure facilities and inspiring live entertainment to delicious dining experiences and plenty of history for you to uncover. If this sounds like your kind of getaway, Warner Hotels is now offering a series of exciting weekend packages in 2024. Each three-night stay is at one of three historic hotels, with dinner, bed and breakfast included, plus a whole itinerary of fascinating talks and Q&As with a selection of BBC history experts, such as Tracy Borman, Susanna Lipscomb and James Holland. So what are you waiting for? Book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. What was it like to give birth in the 16th or 17th century? Well, to tell us more, today's guest is Dr. Sarah Reed, lecturer in English at Loughborough University and a specialist in early modern culture and women's reproductive health. Following the release of her historical novel, The Gossip's Choice, Sarah joined BBC History Revealed staff writer Emma Slattery-Williams to discuss the experience of pregnancy and childbirth in early modern England.
How much do people know about childbirth in England during the early modern period? How much knowledge did they have?
I always think that people in early modern England had a lot more knowledge about labour and childbirth than probably we do now. If you think about going as a first-time mum to antenatal classes and you've not probably ever been to a labour, you've not heard anybody in labour, you've probably never even, in some cases, touched a newborn or held a newborn. Whereas in the early modern period, because everybody gave birth at home, or almost everybody, birth was part of life. And so you wouldn't escape the sights and sounds of birth in this period when you were growing up, childhood, adolescence. You wouldn't be in the birthing chamber necessarily, but you would hear sounds, you'd see people coming and going, you'd be holding babies. So I think that people in general had much more of an idea about childbirth than we do nowadays, certainly.
Where did they get their information from? Was it kind of talking to each other, or just like you said, kind of being around the birthing room?
A lot of it was talking and passed down. A lot of it was being around. People were giving birth all the time in communities. It was a communal activity, so when a woman was in labour, she would gather a group of friends and neighbours, her women, and they would have family. So afterwards, after a delivery, everybody would just sit around and chat about what had gone on. And so knowledge was passed down in that way, in a very organic, natural way, I think.
So were there early forms of pregnancy tests? Were there ways that people thought they could find out if they were pregnant?
Oh, yes. So the pregnancy tests didn't even have any accurate pregnancy tests until the mid-20th century. So the ways that you would think about whether you'd conceived or not in the early modern period were by seeing how your body reacted to things. So they knew, obviously, that if you missed a period or two, that it was likely that you were pregnant. But missed periods weren't really the main thing that people thought about, because you could miss periods for all sorts of reasons, they thought. And so they'd be looking for other things like if you had sickness or if you had swollen breasts and things like that, and getting an overall picture. But you didn't know for certain that you were pregnant, really, until about 4 months, when you'd had what we still call quickening, that moment where you feel the first flutterings of a baby in your belly. In early modern England, that had a huge significance, because for some people it was felt that was the moment that a soul entered the fetus's body. And so, you had confirmation that it was a living being within you. But also for the pregnant woman, it gave them that sense that, yes, I am actually pregnant. I'm not imagining things. And these are what all these symptoms add up to. It's real now.
What did churching and confinement mean? Because I think these are terms that we associate with pregnancies in the past.
They are the terms that keep coming up, don't they? Confinement's one of those words that's a later word that gets applied backwards, if you see what I mean, onto the early modern period. So it's true to say that upper class women would go into sort of seclusion, into their bedchamber for a period in anticipation of their labour. But that wasn't what most women did. Most women carried on with their everyday lives out of necessity until the point of delivery. But confinement is a term that came into being in this context in the late 18th century, actually. And that was because society was trying to become a lot more polite in those terms and didn't want to refer directly to childbirth. It was a bit vulgar. So they would talk about women's confinement as a euphemism, if you like. But yeah, the actual process of going into this sort of what we would call a confinement happened on a class basis. It wasn't something that was common to most people, I would say. So we hear about it a lot, don't we, in historical dramas, in Tudor things about, you know, queens going into their confinements to wait for their delivery, when they'd be shielded from the outside world, when the curtains were drawn and a fire was lit, and it was a time of contemplation in anticipation of a successful delivery. But as I say, it's not something that featured much in ordinary women's lives. It was a luxury that most couldn't afford. Whereas churching was more universal. Churching is something that actually was quite political throughout the early modern period. So in the times before Henry VIII's Reformation, churching was a ceremony where the woman who'd given birth went to church to be ceremonially washed away of her sins of labour, all linked back to Eve's sin in the Garden of Eden. After the Reformation, there was people wanted to keep the ceremony, but they did reinvent it, if you like, as a ceremony, a celebration, to say thank you to God for a safe delivery. So rather than being something that took away a taint, a stain of sin, it was a thanksgiving ceremony. But it endured throughout the early modern period. It just was slightly envisaged to work in a slightly different way, depending on where you sat on the religious spectrum, from Catholicism to Protestantism, and the way that you thought about it. So at different periods throughout the 17th century, it had different practices. Some high church and Catholic faiths thought that women shouldn't even enter a church until after she'd been through this ceremony, until she'd been church, because she wasn't clean. Whereas others know it was part of being received back into the congregation, and it was all a communal celebration that she'd got through her ordeal. She was alive and well, and with God's help, she'd survived to tell the tale.
Just going back to the confinement there for the nobility, how far along in their pregnancy would they be expected to go into seclusion?
It varied. There's different accounts of different members of the aristocracy, but anything up to a few weeks. And it's quite a hard thing to think about, I think, for a modern woman, the idea that you'd be cut off from the outside world for a few weeks in a darkened room. And in lots of ways, it would make you very unprepared for a physical ordeal that labour, I mean, you know, labour is a physical process, and keeping active and healthy beforehand is one of the best ways of preparing your body. But in the thinking about aristocratic women was that they were generally weaker constitutionally than your average woman, because, you know, to do with the fact that they were aristocratic and more refined. And so they needed to be shielded in that sort of a way. But there's also things that they would do during this time to help prepare their bodies. So they might have baths in medicated waters with, you know, certain herbs and flowers added that would sort of soften, or was thought to soften, the body to make the delivery more smooth. So they might be doing some active things while they were in confinement. But generally it was, you know, it was keep everybody away. And this quiet period, she wasn't alone. Obviously, she'd have her women with her, so she'd have her waiting women, her entourage, if you like. So it wasn't that she was alone, it was just that she was cut off from the outside world.
It does sound quite a lonely time, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it must have been a very disorientating process, because, you know, it came part and parcel with having the curtains drawn and with the fire on high, you know, banked up, roaring away. It's quite uncomfortable in lots of ways if you were expecting in sort of spring and summertime.
Absolutely. So who would you go to when you're about to give birth? Would it be a physician or would it be a midwife?
Nearly all women were delivered by a midwife. There was no equivalent of antenatal care in the era. So you only went to see your midwife or a physician or a surgeon or any medic if you had a problem in pregnancy. It was just assumed for the rest of the time that you took good care of yourself and that you call for a midwife when the labour pains, the contractions had started. But yeah, as I say, most women, by far the vast majority, were delivered by their local midwife. There could be two kinds, really, of midwife practicing. So you had your trained midwife, and she was trained by apprenticeship. Not by, nowadays it's a degree as well as the hands-on experience, isn't it? So it's a joint process, but it's seen as a discrete professional skill you have to go to university to study for. Interestingly, in early modern times, trainee midwives, who are called deputy midwives, study for a similar amount of time to that which trainee midwives do today. So a 3-4 year degree course. Midwives in the past studied for a 3-6 year apprenticeship. And the apprenticeship was very much hands-on. It was practical. It was learning an art, which is what all sort of hands-on trades were, like artisan trades. So you learnt the art of midwifery by watching, by learning from somebody who was doing. And at the end of your training, you went through a licensing process that was run by the church, not by a medical board. And you went before the bishop. And to go before the bishop for licensing as a midwife, you needed testimonials of about 6 women you'd successfully delivered. So when you got to the end of your years as a deputy, the midwife you were working for, apprentice to, would let you take over on purpose so that you could then gather testimonials from women who you'd delivered, who could say that you were good at the job and you'd help them. And these women would sign, or their husbands would testify in their place quite often. And you had to swear a midwife's oath before the bishop, which included things like promising to not distinguish between rich and poor, so not be called away from a poor woman's delivery to go and attend to a rich woman, for example. It made you promise that if a baby died in birth, that you would give it a decent burial, because if it was delivered before it could be baptised, it couldn't go through and be buried in sanctified ground in a churchyard. But you'd make sure that you gave it a decent burial and made sure it was properly, deeply buried so that it couldn't be dug up by a pig or a dog, is what the actual midwife's oath says. So it was a church process again. So, you know, we're back to ideas about churching, but just again, it shows you how involved the church was in everyday life in the 17th century. And the other kind of midwife who was around, who was called a handwoman. It's the same sort of thing as farmhand, you know, that sort of derivation. And handwomen weren't trained in the same way that midwives, licensed midwives were. They hadn't gone through a formal apprenticeship. They might have worked alongside a midwife. They might just be an older woman in the area who'd been to lots of deliveries and was skilled and had the practical skills. But between them, hand women and midwives delivered the vast majority of women. If things went wrong, say there was a malpresentation and the woman was in difficulties, the baby was in difficulties, and it was beyond the midwife's capabilities to intervene, then the local barber surgeon might be called for, who could carry out a surgical procedure. Maybe he could use some instruments and to help pull the baby out. But things like forceps that weren't part of a midwife's kit at this time, that came to being much later.
I think that's quite surprising. I think we have this assumption that if you had a baby, it was just delivered by a woman in the village who had delivered a lot of babies. Did it depend on your class whether you got a licensed midwife or not?
No, it didn't depend on your class. It depended on availability, who was around. So in big towns, you might have 3 or 4 midwives. In a small town, there might just be one midwife. Or there might be no licensed midwives. And you say it's the local woman, the hand woman, who delivered everybody. So it depended on availability more than anything. Coming back to class, if you were a member of the aristocracy, then you may have a physician attend. But physicians weren't all that plentiful because they were university educated. They weren't all that hands-on generally, but aristocratic families liked to have them at their deliveries as a status symbol, and also hopefully, you know, because they thought that they would prevent anything from going on. But generally, even under a physician supervision, it would be the midwife who delivered the infant.
So this does sound like it was very much a woman's world. What was the father's role? Were they ever allowed in the room?
Not really. It wasn't a father's place. They would have felt like a fish out of water in the all-female environment of a birthing chamber. It was a very female environment. So you had the labouring woman and her group of friends, her gossips, as they were called, who supported her. The father's role was practical in terms of it would be him who would go and send for the midwife. As soon as the woman felt her labour pains starting, it would be him who would send for her women, you know, gather everybody round. And so very much also looking after the children and keeping things going, because a lot of people worked at home in cottage industries. So holding the fort was the father's role, and seeing the practical aspects. So it wasn't as though, while they weren't in the birthing chamber, they were still in the home generally.
So during this period, what were the rates of survival for a mother and a child?
The rates of survival for women is much higher than people think, actually. So one study, for example, and it tends to be fairly representative of several that I've seen, says that the death rate between 1650 and 74 is, the death rate was 17 per thousand, so 1.7%. It's under 2%, which is still high for to us. I mean, the idea that we all might know in our circle, or if you think about how many Facebook friends you've got, for example, you know, if that number's in hundreds, then you might know one or two women who died in childbirth, is shocking to us. But it's still much lower than perhaps popular myth puts out there. For babies, almost a quarter of them didn't survive their first year, which is, again, it's something that is beyond our comprehension, really, isn't it, in terms of the emotional toll that would have taken on women and their families, on fathers as well. And it did, and there's no doubt about that. It used to be very fashionable 50 years ago to write about how sort of emotionally closed off families were, so that they, because they knew that they would lose a certain proportion of their children, that they didn't love them in the way that we love our children. But that's just not historically representative at all. People were devastated by losing their children. And the thing is that up to a quarter of them would die in infancy before one. And then just over a third of children wouldn't make it to their 15th birthday. So I suppose what we can do to be a little bit more upbeat is to say almost two-thirds of children made it past 15 into adulthood. That's a slightly happier way of thinking about it, I suppose.
What were the common causes of things going wrong during labour at this time?
Yeah, things did go wrong. And I think that's the biggest difference, you know, between then and now, is that while the vast majority, just like now, of labours are straightforward and result in a, you know, the mother's fine and the baby is born problem-free, the biggest difference between then and now is that when something went wrong, there wasn't really much chance of a happy outcome. And the sorts of things that could go wrong would be perhaps a malpresentation, the baby presenting in an awkward way that made it very difficult for them to be born. But midwives were very skilled at manipulating babies. They were much, much more hands-on than a midwife nowadays would want to encourage, in terms of always putting their hands in and examining the woman. So if anybody's had recent experience in a maternity unit, you know that midwives like to limit the number of physical examinations for fear of introducing infection, quite rightly. But in the early modern times, midwives were much more keen to insert their hands into checking where things were. But part of that meant that they became very skilled with their hands at manipulating babies, and they could usually get out of most predicaments like that by manipulating the infant in such a way that they could get the child out. But things that now that are still emergencies nowadays, like placenta previa, where the placenta is in front of the cervix, so blocking the exit, or placental abruption, which is, you know, life-threatening emergency nowadays, were invariably fatal because there was nothing surgically that anybody could do to stop that from killing the mother. So it was a question of, while things progressed normally in well over 90% of cases, when things went wrong, there was often an unhappy outcome. And it was when things were going wrong that you would send for backup in terms of the barber surgeon, and seeing if there was anything that he could do, because he would be a man, to intervene.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And that people were very ignorant, and people weren't at all ignorant. There was an awful lot of knowledge passed around in groups. People had a really good working knowledge of medication in terms of herbal medicines, and how to mix really quite complicated treatments. So they might make what they call simples, which have only got one ingredient.
Time for another quick chat about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you want to get away in 2024, why not book a weekend package at one of Warner's most historic hotels? There's Littlecote House, which is a stunning Tudor manor in Hungerford, Studley Castle, a beautiful 19th century building in Warwickshire, or Home Lacey, a huge Herefordshire mansion that was once visited by Charles I. Whichever location you choose, you'll be able to enjoy a whole weekend of live talks from your favourite historians during your stay. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Were cesareans ever used? And if so, presumably that would be extremely risky for the mother, especially with infection.
Yeah. Yeah, so you hear there are always perennial anecdotes about somebody performing a successful cesarean, but not really. There weren't something that was part of life, and you know, vanishingly small examples of it. Where they were used is if the mother had died and there was any possibility at all of saving the infant, then they were performed to quickly whip the baby out. So that's the only example you see normally in midwifery textbooks about when such a thing is permissible or even possible.
So what kind of medical instruments did they use during examinations and labour?
So during examinations and labour, one of the main pieces of equipment, which again is coming back round into common usage, is the birthing chair. And this is very much like an armchair, or it could be something that looks more like a dairy stool, a three-legged stool. But the chair had a horseshoe hole cut in it so that when the woman sat upon it, the birth passage was free. And the midwife would kneel down in front of the labouring woman to do her examinations. And also she would remain in that position to deliver the infant into her arms. And the chair was part of a midwife's equipment. Quite often she would either see that it was taken to a client a few days before delivery was anticipated, or bring it with her in a sort of portable form, actually, when she was called. So midwives sometimes had a nickname in the era, Mother Chair, because they were sort of seen as synonymous with their chair. But failing that, women would sit on the edge of the bed for examinations, so getting into a similar position. And that's when her gossips, her female attendants, came into their own, because they would sit behind her and hold her up and give her that physical support. Other equipment midwives had are recognisable with midwifery today. So scissors, of course, we know that midwives have their scissors ready for cutting the umbilical cord, but also in terms of making little cuts if they need to. And midwives had a range of hooks that they might use for breaking water, but might also use in the case where an infant had passed away in the uterus for helping get them out. But often they use their hands. So if they wanted to break the waters, where a little crochet hook could be used or scissors could be used, midwifery books will say, well, be careful with things like that so you don't nick the infant. And the midwife would often prefer to use her fingernails in that circumstance.
That's interesting that you said that the birthing chair is coming back in use. So they obviously did have a lot of knowledge that was useful.
Yes, they did. I mean, the main thing that they knew that was useful is the key to keeping active. Women wandering up and down their birthing chambers is one of the things you see repeatedly written about in midwifery guides. Between labour pains, so between her throes, as they used to call them. And if you could keep upright and if you could keep active to that extent, so take a little bit of exercise in between contractions, maybe sit down when a pain was upon her, sit in the chair. And we know that where it's possible, that does help. So we see birthing chairs in lots of delivery suites now. And similar to the balls that they have, which women can sit, and they're all get the pelvis into a good position for a natural delivery.
So this period was often people still held on to certain superstitions and things. Were there any kind of charms or, say, magical objects people used to use to help them have a safe delivery?
Yeah, again, it comes around to ideas about pre and post Reformation and different ends of the religious spectrum. So before the Reformation of Henry VIII and the invention of the Church of England, it was very, very common to have amulets and to have superstitious objects that women would cling on to in birth or wear about on their person during pregnancy and labour to help. Those went out of favour in the post-Reformation period. They were thought to be superstitious and therefore they weren't encouraged. But that didn't mean they went out altogether. But between the previous periods, so you would have things like girdles, for example, that were made out of paper that might have prayers written on them, and their woman would wear around her belly in the last weeks of labour, last weeks of pregnancy and into her labour. There was one example at a priory that's just in the Midlands, just up the road from where I am, at Grace Dew Priory, and it was the girdle of St. Francis that women would borrow when they were in labour, and they would tie it around themselves, and it was said to take away their pain. And women pre-Reformation believed in these things. But some things carried on. So one piece of equipment that a midwife might bring with her is something called an eagle stone, which is a geode. It's a naturally occurring rock. And it's the best way to visualise it is to think about, you know, those little balls that cats play with that's got a little bell inside but is a ball. And yeah, that's what an eagle stone's like. So it's a rock with a little rock inside it. And this was thought to have all sorts of properties and thought to work really effectively. So if a woman wore an eagle stone attached to her belly, it was thought to help prevent miscarriage. In labour, it might be strapped around her thigh to encourage the fetus out. And they were thought to be very effective, and you had to use them with care. So that carried on right through the 17th century, past all the religious changes, and was acceptable no matter where you stood, really, on the religious spectrum. So I think that's interesting that these artefacts, some of them did survive being outlawed, if you like, and were held in high esteem by reputable practitioners. You know, so you know, your fully licensed, highly esteemed midwife would carry an eagle stone with it and generally believe in its effectiveness.
Was there any pain relief available for birthing mothers?
Yes. How effective it was is a moot point, but there was lots. So it was expected that women would have some pain in labour because of Eve's sin in the Garden of Eden and it being her punishment. So women expected to experience some pain. What wasn't acceptable was excruciating pain, unbearable pain. And midwives had a lot of ways of dealing with that. Most of the pain relief was designed to open up the passages of the body to help the labourer along. And so they would start off with something very gentle, like a cordial, like a drink with some cinnamon in it, maybe. The idea being that you're just opening up the body a little bit. And they would progress to stronger and stronger versions of the same sorts of things. So you might get a mix of saffron in some wine and sack, which is a very sweet fortified wine, with some powdered herbs and cinnamon again, dittany, things like that, and designed to calm and relax the woman, but also to open up a body. But you can see that the strong wine would have a relaxing effect again, and maybe if some of the anxiety was taken away, her pains might lessen. And they could go up though to things like a fume, which they used to place in a heated chafing dish, so that and put some items in it, things like ambergris, musk, and burn them in a chafing dish. So like with a flame underneath the dish, and the fumes would rise up, and they pop that underneath the birthing chair, and the fumes would rise through the hole in the birthing chair and go into the woman's vagina and have the same effect as the pain relieving medications that she might take by mouth, but working directly on the passages. So there was all sorts of things that we tried. It wasn't as though anybody just left women struggling. So the treatments could even go up to opiate-based medications that we know would be effective.
We often get this idea that even now, in some respects, the woman's body was a mystery to physicians. How much did they actually understand about the female reproductive system and, you know, exactly what happened, how much pain women were expected to experience?
Physicians, they had a good working theoretical knowledge of women's bodies. The theories about women's bodies, well, and men's bodies, went back to ancient times. And to be a physician, you had to complete a university postgraduate education in medicine. So all physicians did a humanities degree to make sure that they had got a good working knowledge of classical texts. But then they would do postgraduate medical studies. And that would involve studying ancient texts. So Hippocrates, the corpus that came out at that time, Galen, Aristotle, and all that was for 2,000 years informed medical practice. So there were mistaken ideas in there that kept being repeated. So theoretical knowledge is one thing, but as I said, I think earlier, physicians tended to be quite hands-off. They would very often diagnose conditions by letter, by listening to symptoms, but not really getting that sort of hands-on involvement that midwives were known for. So midwives, medics, medical men, doctors could actually be less knowledgeable and less competent when it came to women's bodies than the women who routinely helped each other, and the hand women who would have the knowledge of herbs and what would take away pain, or, you know, right from everyday pains like period pains right through to helping with labour pains. So, yeah, there was a definite difference.
So what would you say are the biggest misconceptions we have about women's bodies and childbirth during the early modern period?
I think the biggest misconceptions are that everybody died, you know, that it was fatal almost all the time, when in actual fact most people got on with it and were fine. And so you see that myth quite a lot coming backwards and forwards, and that people were very ignorant, and people weren't at all ignorant. There was an awful lot of knowledge passed around in groups. People had a really good working knowledge of medication in terms of herbal medicines, and how to mix really quite complicated treatments. So they might make what they call simples, which have only got one ingredient. So a cordial with just some cinnamon in would be a simple cordial. Then they might make complex ones where she's got several ingredients mixed together in all sorts of different ways, right up to distillation. So you would see even quite aristocratic women being skilled in distillation and making refined medications like that. So this again comes back to this idea that people were ignorant. In actual fact, people were very knowledgeable and quite skilled in ways that, you know, we don't really always acknowledge.
Yeah, I think we maybe underestimate people of the past sometimes, don't we? And I think it's interesting what you said about how it affected them when they lost the child, because I think we still do think that because people were having so many more children than we do today, and that family life was quite different, that it wouldn't have affected them as much. They would have seen it as part of life that they would lose a child. But you are saying that it is clear that it would have affected the whole family.
Oh, absolutely it did. I mean, there's some harrowing messages in diaries and letters that remain, multitudes of them, from people writing about losing children. So Lady Anne Fanshawe wrote about losing one of her children and how her and her husband wanted to jump in the grave. They were so distraught. And that just brings it home, doesn't it? It still gives me goosebumps when I think about that. John Evelyn, the diarist who was friends with Samuel Pepys, lost a daughter in her teens to smallpox, and wrote about how devastated, absolutely devastated he was at her loss. He was very close to his daughters, and so, you know, right from infants to teenage children, we've got accounts of people being distraught.
So you mentioned earlier that a woman's attendants were known as gossips, and that leads quite nicely onto your first novel, which is called The Gossip's Choice, which was published last year. Firstly, before you tell me about the book, why were they called gossips?
It derives from the same root as godparent, interestingly enough. So it was sort of God's helper, so you're there in God's place. And this then gets shortened to gossip, which both godparents and gossips were known as. And so, yeah, so you were there to support a woman through labour. So you were doing God's work in helping her. So that's where gossips came from. But then, of course, it has the unfortunate connotation that all these women locked in a room, what were they talking about all day? And it could be quite a bawdy environment, you know, lots of rude jokes going around. And that's where we get the sort of idea of gossiping comes from, as we use it, from worries about what women might have been talking about.
So your book is about a midwife working during the Great Plague of 1665.
Yeah.
How did the plague affect the experience of childbirth?
Well, we're lucky in that we've got an account of that from Daniel Defoe, the 18th century author. He wrote Journal of a Plague Year, and his character, his narrator in that, says that one of the most awful, in his opinion, side effects of the plague ravaging the city was that women were left without any neighbouring women or without a midwife to attend them and had to give birth on their own. And this could be for a number of reasons. It could be because they simply had lost people to the plague and there weren't any midwives around. It could be that people didn't want to go into other people's houses, something that we can now visualise and empathise with in ways that even 2 years ago we couldn't. You know, that fear of going into somebody else's house or being forbidden to go into somebody else's house. And HF, the narrator of the Journal of the Plague Year, he talks about how harrowing it was to hear labouring women crying out for assistance and not receiving any.
So what made you decide to embark on writing a novel based on your research?
Because doing the research, I found all these fascinating stories, and the incidents in the book, as bizarre as some of them will seem to a modern reader, are all based on true stories. So a lot of the incidents I've taken from the case notes of a midwife who worked in Somerset in the early 18th century called Sarah Stone. And Sarah Stone worked in Bridgewater, she worked in Truro, she worked in Bristol and then latterly in London. And she published in 1737, she published 40-odd case notes of cases where things had gone wrong, but she'd gone in and saved the day. But it gave me so much material as a novelist, because the case notes are very basic. They might be, say, 200 words, and they'll just say a farmer's wife was called in. They're the women are always noted by in terms of their husbands. So from a novelist perspective, you've got the opportunity to fashion a whole character. So, for example, in one incident, Sarah Stone was called to Bloomfield's farm. Well, in my novel there, I take the name of the farm as their family name, so it becomes Jenny Bloomfield, who's got the problems, and I can expand the 200-word bold case note into a whole 3,000-word chapter about the story, because from the case notes, you don't get any sense of the feelings of the labouring woman. You don't get any sense of what the women around were doing and feeling and what the midwife did, actively did, because Sarah Stone doesn't quite tell you what she did.
How different did you find writing the novel compared to academic writing?
It was a learning curve. So in academic work, we're taught concision, get to the point, cite lots of sources. In writing a novel, you've got to do, in some respects, the opposite. You've got to take people gently into your world so that they can see and they can feel and they can almost taste and smell what's going on around them. So all those are different skills that you have to practice and get used to using, to showing and telling in all sorts of different ways. But it was a hugely enjoyable process, and one I'm so glad I did. It's a way of getting these stories out there in a way that, you know, if I'd have published in a journal article about Sarah Stone, which I mean I have, it would be read by a handful of people, whereas doing it this way, it's a story that people can relate to.
Do you have any more novels in the pipeline?
Yes, there's a sequel. I originally planned the Gossip's Choice storyline, but it's taken two books to write, because I found that there was a whole book in what was going to be part one was actually a whole book. So the sequel, called The Midwife's Truth, and that's a bit of an exclusive for you there. I don't think I've said the title anywhere else. It's going to come out in April next year.
That was Dr. Sarah Reed. Her novel, The Gossip's Choice, is out now, published by Wild Pressed Books. The sequel is due to be published next year. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow when Tom Standage will be charting the long history of motion and transport. Are you enjoying the History Extra podcast and want to delve a bit deeper into history? Why not take out a subscription for BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine, and receive a brand new book of your choice worth £25. Choose from either Powers and Thrones by Dan Jones, a signed edition, The Anglo-Saxons by Mark Morris, Crown and Scepter by Tracy Borman, or Soldiers by Max Hastings. Your subscription includes delivery of every issue right to your door. Receive all of this for just £22.45 every 6 issues. To take advantage of this fantastic offer, visit our official online store at buysubscriptions.com/myhistorybook. This promotion is only available for UK residents and while stocks last. See our website for further details. Overseas subscription prices are available online.
Before you go, one final word about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you fancy a break in 2024, you can now choose from 3 fantastic weekend packages at some of the most historic Warner hotels. For instance, Littlecote House is set in a stunning location in Hungerford, which has played host to Romans, a Civil War army, and the planning of the D-Day landings. Meanwhile, Studley Castle in Warwickshire was used as a training camp for the Women's Land Army during the World Wars. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.